guides us onward. Our task is to keep it always pointed in the right direction. Reverend Mother Angelou, famed breeding mistress. Wellington Ewey had a powerful need to be forgiven. The blank spot in his mind was filled with guilt. He was just a Gola and only 13, but he knew he had done terrible things. His own history clung to him like tar to his shoe. In his first life, he had broken his Sook conditioning. He had failed his wife Wana by allowing the Harkonnens to use her as a pawn and had betrayed Duke Leto, bringing about the Atreides' downfall on Arrakis. After studying records of his prior existence, learning in painful detail what he had done, Ewey tried to find solace in considering the Orange Catholic Bible, along with other ancient religions, sects, philosophies, and interpretations that had developed over the millennia. The oft-repeated doctrine of original sin, so unfair, was a particular thorn in his side. Ewey could have made a coward's excuse that he couldn't remember and therefore didn't deserve blame, but that was not the path to redemption. He had to turn elsewhere. Jessica was the only one who could forgive him. The 8 Gola children in Shiana's project had been raised and trained together. Because of their individual personalities, they had formed personal bonds and friendships. Even before they knew the history that should tear them apart, Ewey had tried to be a friend to Jessica. He had read the journals and instructional writings of the original Lady Jessica, bound concubine to the Duke Leto Atreides. She'd also been a reverend mother, an exile, the mother of Muad'Dib, and the grandmother of the tyrant. That long-dead Jessica had been a strong woman, a role model despite how the Bene Gesserit reviled her for her flaw, her weakness, love. Together, the Golas now faced a far greater enemy than the Harkonnens. When Jessica's memories were finally awakened, would the shared threat be sufficient to keep her from wanting to murder him? He had read her own words, as written down by Princess Irulan, expressing her poignant agony of grief. Ewey, 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 1,000,000 deaths were not enough for Ewey. Yes, she was the only one who could offer him any hope of forgiveness. With a clean slate and an open heart, he prayed that it was possible for him to lead an honorable life this time. Jessica often occupied herself in the main conservatory, tending the plants that served as a supplemental food source for the hundreds aboard. She had an affinity for the greenhouse work and was happy to be around the fertile dirt, the misting irrigators, the fleshy green leaves, and sweet-scented flowers. With her bronze hair and oval face, noble and young, she looked exquisitely beautiful. How she and Duke Leto must have loved each other long ago, until Ewey destroyed it all. Jessica looked up from the flowers and lush herbs to focus haunted eyes on Ewey. He said, "Do you mind the company?" "Not yours. It's refreshing to be with someone who doesn't blame me for things I don't remember doing." "I hope you'll grant me the same consideration, my lady." "Please don't call me that, Wellington. At least not yet. I can't be the Lady Jessica until I, well, until I become the Lady Jessica." He tried to guess the reasons for her gloomy mood. "Has Garimi been haranguing you again?" "Some Bene Gesserits won't forgive me for having gone against the strict commands of the sisterhood, for betraying their breeding program." She seemed to be reciting something she had read. "The consequences of that brought down an empire and subjected the human race to thousands of years of tyrannical rule and many more centuries of privation." She let out a bitter laugh. "In fact, If your actions had actually resulted in the death of Paul and me, maybe Bene Gesserit histories would describe you as a hero. I am no hero, Jessica. To his credit, the original Yui had given her and Paul the means to survive in the desert after the Harkonnens stormed Arakeen. He had facilitated their escape, but was that enough for redemption? Could it possibly be? She moved on, smelling the flowers, checking the moist soil. She had a habit of running her fingertips along the leaves, touching the undersides. Yui followed her as she walked through a small grove of dwarf citrus trees. Overhead, the segmented panes of the filtered windows showed only distant starlight and no nearby sun. If they hate us so much, why did the sisters bring us back? Her expression was one of bitter amusement. Bene Gesserits have a terrible habit, Wellington. Even if they know a hook is hidden inside the juicy worm, they'll still bite. They always think they can avoid traps that get the rest of us. But you're a Bene Gesserit yourself. Not anymore. Or not yet. Yui touched his own smooth, unmarked forehead. We're starting over, Jessica. Blank slates. Look at me. The first Yui broke his Sook conditioning, but I was born without the diamond tattoo, entirely unblemished. Maybe that means some things can be erased. Can they? We Golas were raised for one purpose, to become who we once were. But are we anyone in our own right? Or are Golas simply tools? Temporary tenants living in houses on borrowed time until the rightful owners return. What if we don't want those old lives? Is it right for Shiana and the others to force them upon us? What about us as we are right now? Abruptly, the grid work of interlocking solar panes overhead seemed to glow brighter, as if the system had absorbed a wash of outside energy. The rows of densely arranged plants inside the greenhouse chamber became more defined, as if his eyes had suddenly become much more sensitive. Overlaying the whole chamber, he saw a complex mesh of thin, iridescent lines, resolving and focusing. Something was happening. Something Yui had never experienced before. The lines became visible all around them, like fine netting that drifted through the air itself. They crackled with energy. Jessica, what is this? Do you see it? A web. A net. She caught her breath. It's what Duncan Idaho claims to see. Yui's heart lurched. The hunters? A loud security klaxon went off, accompanied by Duncan's voice. Prepare for activation of Holtzman engines. Whenever the nose ship folded space, unguided by a navigator, they risked a disaster. Until now, Duncan's warnings had been unsupported by outside witnesses, though the handlers had proved that the threat from the mysterious enemy was real. From the ship's corridors, Yui heard the shouts of people running to emergency stations. The gossamer stranglehold grew brighter and more powerful, surrounding and infiltrating the whole ship. Surely, everyone could see this. He felt a shudder through the deck, a disorientation, and a slipping as the immense ship folded space. Staring through the conservatory dome, he saw star systems, swirling shapes and colors, as if the contents of the universe had been placed in a mixing bowl and stirred. Suddenly, the Ithaca cruised along elsewhere, far from the snares. Duncan's calm voice came over the intercom. We are safe again, for the moment. Why did we see the net now and never before? Jessica asked. Yui rubbed his chin, his thoughts in turmoil. Perhaps the enemy is using a different sort of net, a stronger one. Or maybe they are testing new ways of tracking and snaring us. We must never voice doubt. We must believe utterly that we can win this struggle against our enemy. But in my darkest times, alone in my quarters, I always wonder, is this truly faith, or is it mere foolishness? Mother Commander Mirbella, Private Chapter House Archives. When Mirbella's small Missionaria Aggressiva Council gathered again, the meeting was tense. In the past year, the sisterhood had sent 7 Shiana surrogates to refugee camps in order to rally the fighters. The counterfeit Shianas had their work cut out for them, convincing fanatics to stand firm in the face of certain defeat. The seemingly unstoppable enemy warships proliferated like the heads of a hydra. No matter how many vessels the humans destroyed, more and more appeared. Given millennia to prepare for his final conquest, Omnius had left nothing to chance. The dots on the star charts showed one planet after another falling under the onslaught of thinking machines. Mirbella sat in a hard and uncomfortable seat at the end of the table. Most of the others selected furry chair dogs. At the head of the table, Bashar Janess Idaho waited at attention, ready to deliver her report. I have news. Good or bad? Mirbella dreaded the answer. Judge for yourself. Her daughter looked haggard, weary, and considerably older than her years. Having undergone the spice agony and extensive Bene Gesserit training, Janess had the ability to slow her body's changes, not for the sake of appearances, but to keep herself strong and limber. The constant fighting required it. Even so, the unending crisis was taking its toll. Mirbella noticed a scar on her daughter's left cheek and a burn mark on her arm. The female Bashar's words were unemotional, but Mirbella could feel the turmoil in her clipped voice. Even before the first enemy battleships were seen in the Jibraith system, the machines sent scout probes to disseminate plagues. The people of Jibraith had already called for an evacuation, but once the first signs of disease appeared, the guild turned their ships around and refused to come closer. One highliner had to be quarantined. Fortunately, the plague was contained within 7 isolated frigates inside its hold. All passengers aboard those frigates died, but the rest were saved. What about the planet itself? Mirbella asked. The plague spread rapidly across all continents. As expected. The current viral strains are far worse than anything previously encountered, more deadly than even the legendary plagues during the Butlerian Jihad. Layera skimmed a Redulian crystal sheet in front of her. Jibraith has a population of 328 million. Not anymore, said Kyria. Janess locked her fingers together, as if to draw strength from her own grip. One of our Shiana surrogates was on Jibraith. As soon as the guild quarantined the planet, the foe Shiana rose to her calling and spoke to crowd after crowd as the plague spread. They knew they would all die. They knew the thinking machine forces were on their way. But she convinced them that if they must die, they should die as heroes. But if the guild ships had already departed, how could they fight? Kyria sounded skeptical. By throwing pebbles? Jibraith had its own in-system frigates, cargo vessels, and transport runners, none of them equipped with Holtzman engines or no fields. As the disease cut people down, survivors raced to create a homegrown military force that might stand against Omnius. The people had to work faster than the epidemic killed them off. She forced her lips into a cold, hard smile as she continued her report. Our false Shiana was like a demon herself. I know for a fact that she went 5 days without sleeping, for the records show she appeared again and again at different cities and factories, rallying the citizenry, forcing them to crawl to their assembly stations if necessary. Nobody bothered with quarantines, since everyone was already infected. As people died in the factories, their bodies were dragged out to mass burial pits and huge bonfires. Others took their places at workstations. Even when the enemy fleet surrounded the world, people did not pause. Then our Shiana disappeared. Janess looked around the table, lowered her voice. Afterward, I learned from a coded Bene Gesserit signal that our surrogate contracted the disease and died from it. Mirbella was startled. Died? How can that be? Any reverend mother knows how to fight off infection. That requires great concentration and significant physical resources. Our Shiana had depleted her reserves. If she'd rested for a day or two, she might have rallied her strength and driven off the disease. But she kept going and going, using up whatever energy reserves she had. Knowing Jibraith was doomed, that the invading machine armies would destroy her if the plague did not, Shiana never slackened in her efforts. Old Acadia nodded. She had pushed the people into a fanatical fervor. No doubt she realized that if they saw her weakened and dying, they would lose their resolve. She was wise to remove herself from public view. Janessa's thin smile showed true admiration. As soon as her symptoms began to manifest, Shiana delivered one last grand speech, telling them she would now ascend to heaven. Then she isolated herself and died alone so that no one could see the horrific plague take its toll on her. A marvelous and brave story for the archival histories. Acadia pursed her withered lips. Her sacrifice will not be forgotten. If anyone still studies the histories after this, Kyria mumbled. And what of the subsequent fight on Jibraith? Mirbella asked. Did the people defend themselves? When the enemy came, the people fought like ancient berserkers, to the last man and woman. Nothing could stop them. They met the enemy fleet with ship after ship flown by grandfathers, teenagers, mothers, husbands, and even criminals released from detention centers. All fought and died bravely. Their sheer ferocity drove back the machines. Even with no defined military force, the people of Jibraith destroyed more than 1,000 enemy vessels. Reality forced ice into Mirbella's voice. My enthusiasm is tempered by the knowledge that even after losing 1,000 vessels, the thinking machines have countless others to throw against us. Still, if all planets fought like that, there might be a chance for humankind to survive, Janess pointed out. The species would be preserved. Choosing her moment to pounce, Kyria peeled crystal sheets from another set of reports, then propped an image projector in the center of the table. The chair dog shifted subtly and compliantly to accommodate her movements. This new report shows why we can't count on all planets. We are being attacked by a rot from within as well as the outside fleet. Mirbella frowned. Where did you get this? Sources. Wearing a smug expression, the former honored Matre activated the projector. While we face the thinking machines head-on, a more devious opponent undermines us from within. The image resolved to show a mob scene. This is Belos IV, but such occurrences have been documented elsewhere. Sparked by helplessness in the face of the approaching enemy fleet, brushfire wars and political struggles are starting on planet after planet. People are afraid. When their leaders don't tell them what they want to hear, they riot, overthrow their prime ministers, and prop others in their place. More often than not, they depose the new leaders as well. We know this. Mirbella looked at Jeunesse, who remained rigidly at attention at the front of the table. She wished her daughter would sit down. On the images, the citizens of Belos IV had risen up against their governor, who had advocated surrender to the oncoming thinking machines. Obviously, the people didn't want to hear such a message. Why is this relevant? Kyria jabbed a sharp-nailed finger at the image. Observe. When the crowd attacked the middle-aged leader, he fought remarkably well, using skills and speed rarely demonstrated by any bureaucrat. While Mirbella watched, she decided the governor must have acquired some sort of special training. His combat methods were unusual and effective, but the mob far outnumbered him. They dragged him through the streets to the balcony of the governor's palace and threw him off onto the flagstones far below. As he lay still, the howling, cheering mob backed away. The images drew in closer. The dead governor shifted and paled. His face became sunken and scarecrowish, somehow unformed. A face dancer. We always suspected the new face dancers had questionable loyalties. They allied themselves with honored Matres and turned against the old Tliloxu. We found them among the rebel whores on Gamu and Tlilox, and now it appears that the threat is even worse than we suspected. Listen to the governor's words. He advocated surrender to the thinking machines. Who are the face dancers really working for? Mirbella reached the obvious conclusion and dragged her sharp gaze like a serrated knife across the other sisters. The new face dancers are puppets of Omnius and have infiltrated our populace. They are far superior to the old ones, able to resist almost any Bene Gesserit technique. We always wondered how the lost Tliloxu could have created them, when their skills were so inferior to those the old masters demonstrated. It did not seem possible. Lyera said coldly, "It is possible if the thinking machines helped to create them, then sent them back among Tliloxu returning from the scattering." A first wave of scouts and infiltrators. Kyria nodded. How far have they spread? Could there be face dancers among us, undetected by truthsayers? Acadia scowled. A frightening thought. If we have no way of exposing these new face dancers. From what I can tell, their mimicry is perfect. Nothing is perfect, Mirbella said. Even thinking machines have flaws. Without humor, Kyria said, Oh, we can identify them easily enough. Kill them and face dancers revert to their blank state. So you suggest we simply kill everyone? That's what the enemy intends to do anyway. Restless, Mirbella stood up. She could remain here on Chapter House with the other anxious sisters, receive reports for another year, listen to summaries, and plot the advance of the thinking machines on a map as if it were some kind of war game. Meanwhile, the Ixian engineers struggled to build weapons equivalent to the obliterators, and the guild shipyards worked to produce thousands of ships, all of them equipped with mathematical compilers. But the crisis went far beyond internal politics and power struggles. She decided to go out there herself and travel among the worlds on the edge of the war zone, not as Mother Commander, but as a keen observer. She would let a council of Reverend Mothers run the everyday activities here on Chapter House, dealing with bureaucratic matters and doling out spice rations to the guild in order to ensure their cooperation. When Mirbella announced her intent, Lyera cried, Mother Commander, that's not possible. We need you here. There's so much to do. I represent more than the new sisterhood. Since no one else will step up to the plate, I am responsible for the whole human race. She sighed. Somebody has to be. Our no-ship holds many secrets, yes, but not nearly the number we hold inside ourselves. Leto II, the Gola. Leto II and Thufir Hawat had never known each other in their original lifetimes. To them, that was not a disadvantage. It left them free to form a friendship without any expectations or preconceptions. 9-year-old Leto hurried ahead down the corridor. Come with me, Thufir. Now that nobody's watching, I can show you a special place. Another one? Do you spend all your days exploring instead of studying? If you're going to be deputy chief of security, you need to know everything about the Ithaca. Maybe we'll find your saboteur down here. Leto turned sharply right, dropped into a small emergency lift, then paused at a dim lower deck where everything seemed larger and darker. He led Thufir to a sealed hatch that was posted with warnings and restrictions in half a dozen languages. Despite the locks, he opened it with barely a pause. Thufir looked puzzled, even a little offended. How did you bypass security so easily? This ship is old, and systems break down all the time. Nobody even knows this one failed. He ducked into the low passageway. The tunnel on the other side was a whistling cool air channel. Up ahead, the roaring grew louder, and the wind became powerful. Thufir sniffed. Where does it go? To an air exchange filtration system. The passages were smooth and curving, like worm tunnels. A shiver brushed across Leto's skin, perhaps from a memory of when he had been joined with numerous sand trout, from when he was the god emperor of Dune, the tyrant. The two reached the central recyclers where large fans drove the air through thick curtains of filter mats, scrubbing out particulates and purifying the atmosphere. Breezes tugged at the boy's hair. Ahead, sheets of filtration material blocked further passage. The lungs of the ship, replenishing and redistributing oxygen. Recently, Thufir had begun to mark his lips with a cranberry red stain. As the pair stood in the bowels of the ship, listening to the roaring wind, Leto finally asked, "Why do you do that to your mouth?" Self-consciously, the 14-year-old rubbed his lips. My original used the Sappho drug, which made stains like these. The Bashar wants me to live the part. He says he's preparing to awaken my memories. Thufir didn't sound entirely pleased with the situation. Shiana has been talking about forcing me to remember. She has some special technique to trigger a Gola's awakening. Aren't you excited at the prospect? Thufir Hawat was a great man. The other boy remained preoccupied and troubled. It's not that, Leto. I really don't want my memories back. But Shiana and the Bashar have their minds made up. That's why you were created. Leto was baffled. Why wouldn't you want your past life? The Master of Assassins would not be afraid of the ordeal. I'm not afraid. I'd just rather be the person I choose to become and not emerge fully formed. I don't feel I've earned it. Trust me, they'll make you earn it once you become the real Thufir again. I am the real Thufir. Or do you doubt that too? Thinking of the restless worm that crouched inside him, aware of all the atrocious things he would soon remember, Leto understood completely. By following the same beliefs and making the same decisions, one wears life's path into a circular rut, going nowhere, accomplishing nothing, making no progress. With God's help, though, we can turn a sharp corner in the circle and achieve enlightenment. The Cant of the Shariat. At last, Woff was ready to release his new worms, and Boozle was a convenient ocean planet on Edric's standard trade route. A perfect testbed. The giant vessel carried merchants who traded in Soustones. Earlier, when honored Matres had conquered Boozle and killed most of the exiled Reverend Mothers, the whores had taken the Soustone wealth for themselves. Since then, few of the aquatic gems had been traded on the galactic market, which made their value skyrocket. Now that the new sisterhood had recaptured Boozle, Soustone production was up again. The witches ran tightly regimented operations there and kept smugglers at bay, thus maintaining stable but high prices for the stones. With mercenary armies to protect them, Chome merchants began to sell large quantities of the gems, reaping profits before a glut drove prices down again. A temporary market fluctuation. Though pretty and desirable, Soustones were not necessary. Melange, on the other hand, was vital, as the navigators well knew. Woff knew that his experiments would eventually produce far more wealth than these undersea baubles could ever represent. Soon, if his expectations were met, Boozle would be home to something far more interesting than baubles. The Highliner appeared above the liquid sapphire world, where tiny islands dotted the expansive ocean. Boozle's oceans were deep and fertile, a large zone where the genetically altered worms would thrive, provided they survived their initial baptism. The Tleilaxu master paced the cold metal floor of his laboratory chamber. Soon, Edric would inform him that the commercial lighters and cargo transports had disembarked for the island outposts. Once they were safely gone, Woff could begin his real work on Boozle without being observed. Inside the lab, the smell of salt, iodine, and cinnamon had replaced harsh chemical odors. Woff's test tanks were full of murky green water, rich with algae and plankton. Once turned loose in the oceans, the modified worms would have to find their own sources of nourishment, but Woff was sure they could adapt. God would make it all possible. Serpentine forms swam about in the tanks looking like ringed eels. Their ridges were an iridescent blue-green, showing a soft pink membrane between segments, a surrogate set of gills that absorbed oxygen from the water. Their mouths were round like those of lampreys. Though they had no eyes, the new sea worms could navigate using water vibrations in much the way that Rakian worms had been attracted by tremors in the dunes. Using carefully mapped models from sand trout chromosomes, Woff knew that these creatures had the same internal metabolic reactions as a traditional sandworm. Therefore, they should still produce spice. But Woff didn't know what kind of spice or how it would be harvested. He stepped back, interlocking his grayish fingers. That wasn't his problem or concern. He had done as Edric commanded. He only wanted the worms back. It had taken more than a year out of his accelerated lifetime, but if Woff succeeded in resurrecting God's messengers, his destiny would be complete. Even if the little man never received another Gola lifetime, he would have earned his place beside God in the highest levels of heaven. Under proper conditions, sand trout specimens reproduced swiftly. From them, he had adapted nearly 100 sea worms, most of which he would deposit in the oceans of Boozle. For a new species to survive, especially in an unfamiliar environment, the creatures faced quite a challenge, and Woff fully expected that many of his test specimens would die. Maybe most of them. But he was also convinced that some would live. Enough to establish a foothold. Woff stood on his tiptoes, pressing his face to the tank. "If you are in there, Prophet, I will soon give you a whole new domain." 5 guild assistants entered the lab without knocking. When Waff turned abruptly, the sea worms sensed his movement. With a thump, fleshy heads struck the reinforced tank walls. Startled again, Waff turned the other direction. "Passengers have disembarked for Boozle," said one of the gray-clothed men. "Navigator Edric has commanded us to follow your instructions." The five all had oddly distorted heads, swollen brows, and asymmetric facial features. Any Tleilaxu master could have repaired genetic flaws so that their descendants would be more physically attractive. But that would serve no purpose, and Waff had no interest in cosmetics. He gestured to the tanks as the guildsmen sealed them for transport. "Exercise extreme care. Those creatures are worth more than all your lives." The reticent assistants installed handles on the crowded tanks and began lugging them along the curving halls of the Highliner. Knowing he had only 4 hours to complete his task before the passenger shuttles returned, Waff urged them to hurry. Because of the schism in the guild between navigators and administrators, some people might not wish him to create this new avenue for spice production. The Ixians, the New Sisterhood, even the bureaucratic faction of the guild might all work together or separately to assassinate him. Waff didn't know how or why these particular 5 guildsmen had been chosen to assist him. If he expressed any misgivings about them, Waff knew that the navigator would not hesitate to have all 5 killed, just to keep his Tleilaxu researcher happy. As the troop walked to a small transport craft, Waff decided that was exactly what he would do. Get rid of these men, these witnesses, afterward. The sample tanks were loaded aboard the small transport. Waff did not usually leave the safe confines of the Highliner, but he insisted on accompanying the crew down to the open sea. It was his experiment, and he wanted to be there in person to make sure the worms were released properly. He didn't trust the 5 guildsmen to be sufficiently competent or attentive. Then his suspicions ran deeper. What was to stop these men from flying off in the ship, revealing or selling the sea worms to one of the opposing factions? Could they be perfectly loyal to Edric? Waff saw danger everywhere. As the transport dropped out of the cargo bay, Waff wished belatedly that he had demanded additional bodyguards, or at least a sufficiently powerful hand weapon for himself. Whom could he really trust? Using technological apparatus connected to their throats, the silent guildsmen communicated with each other electronically, transmitting brain signals without voicing words. He knew they could speak aloud. Why would they be so secretive? Perhaps they were plotting against him. Waff looked at the immense Highliner far overhead and wished fervently for this to be over. The small transport descended into the cloudy skies, fighting choppy air currents. Waff felt ill. Finally, they broke through the moisture layers, and the oceans below sprawled out to every horizon. On charts displayed across the cockpit screens, Waff searched for a temperate zone where he could deposit the test worms, a place where the seas were rich with plankton and fish. It would give the creatures the greatest chance for survival. He indicated a line of rocks not far from the Sisterhood's main island base and the center of their soustone harvesting operations. There. Safe and close enough to monitor the worms. He smiled, already imagining the first panicked reports of eyewitnesses. Any rumors or wild stories should be interesting. The guildsmen nodded, all business. The transport ship flew low over the waves and hovered above the gentle swells. The lower cargo hatch opened, and Waff went down to observe the emptying of the tanks. He smelled the raw salt air, the tang of floating kelp, the wet breezes that whipped across the sea. A squall was about to begin. Using the handles, two of the silent guildsmen brought the first tank to the opening, released the plaz cover sheet, and spilled the water and writhing sea worms into the freedom of the waiting waves. The serpentine creatures burst out like frantic snakes. Once they plunged into the green water, they streaked away. Waff watched their ridged bodies undulating, then diving and disappearing. They seemed joyous in their newfound freedom, glad to have a large world without plaz boundaries. Brusquely, he gestured to the guildsmen, telling them to release the rest of the worms, emptying all of the aquariums. Waff had kept one crowded tank of specimens aboard the Highliner, and he could always create more. As he stood by the open hatch, he suddenly shuddered, realizing his vulnerability. Now that he had turned the worms loose, would Edric even require his services anymore? The Tleilaxu man feared the silent assistants might shove him overboard and leave him floating kilometers from the nearest speck of land. Warily, he backed deeper into the cargo hold and gripped a ridged wall strut. But the guildsmen made no move against him. They performed their work exactly as he told them to, and precisely as the navigator had specified. Perhaps Waff was fearful only because he intended to have these men killed. He naturally suspected they would think the same about him. Waff anticipated the sea worms would thrive here. The environment was conducive to their growth and reproduction. The worms would mark their territory, and when they grew large enough, they would become leviathans of the deep. A fitting form for the prophet. The transport's cargo doors sealed again with a low hiss, and the guild pilot flew away. Waff and his party would arrive back at the Highliner well before the merchant vessels returned with their loads of soustones. No one would be the wiser. The Tleilaxu master glanced through the cockpit's plaz port to see the waves receding. He saw no sign of the sea worms, but he knew they were down there somewhere. He let out a contented sigh, confident that his prophet would come back. It is the principle of the ticking time bomb, a strategy of aggression that has long been part of human violence. Thus we have inserted our time bombs into the cells of Golas, activating specific behaviors at precise moments of our choosing. From The Secret Manual of Tleilaxu Masters. The no-ship had its own time, its own cycles. Most of the people were asleep, except for off-shift watches and maintenance crews. The decks were quiet. The glow panels dimmed. In the shadowy chamber that held the axolotl tanks, the rabbi paced back and forth, murmuring Talmudic prayers. On a surveillance screen, Shiana observed the old man carefully, always alert to prevent any new incident of sabotage. When the saboteur had killed the three Golas and axolotl tanks, he or she had shut down the security imagers, but Bashar Teg had made sure that was no longer possible. Everything was under observation. As a former Souk doctor, the rabbi had access to the medical center. He often spent time with what remained of the woman he'd known as Rebecca. Though the old man had answered all questions the truthsayers asked him, he still hadn't earned her trust. Despite her best efforts, the saboteur and murderer remained at large. And the recent appearance of the glowing net had brought the enemy too close, reminding the passengers of the very real threat. Everyone on board had seen it. Their danger remained unabated. Three relatively new axolotl tanks rested on their platforms. Volunteers had come forward to answer Shiana's call, exactly as she had expected. All three new tanks were currently producing liquid-form melange that dripped into small collecting vials, but she had begun preparations to implant one of the wombs with cells from Cytale's null entropy tube. A new embryo to bring back yet another figure from the past. She refused to let the sabotage deflect her Gola project. The rabbi stood before the new tanks, his tense body exhibiting clear markers of loathing and disgust. He spoke to the fleshy mound. I hate you. Unnatural. Ungodly. After watching the old man carefully, Shiana left the monitor screens and entered the medical center, gliding up behind him. Is it honorable to hate the helpless rabbi? Those women are no longer aware, no longer human. Why despise them? He whirled, lights reflecting on his polished spectacles. Stop spying on me. I wish time alone to pray for Rebecca's soul. Rebecca had been his personal favorite, willing to pit her intellect against his. The old man had never forgiven her for volunteering to become a tank. Even you need to be watched, Rabbi. Anger flushed his leathery skin. You and your witches should have heeded the warnings and ceased your grotesque experiments. If only the honored Matres had managed to get rid of Cytale when they destroyed all Tliloxu worlds, then his hateful knowledge of tanks and golas would have been lost. The honored Matres also hunted down your people, Rabbi. You and the Tliloxu share the same enemy. But it is not the same at all. We have been unfairly persecuted throughout history, while the Tliloxu merely received their just deserts. Their own face dancers turned on them, from what I understand. He took a step away from the fleshy mound, from the chemical and biological odors that wafted from the tanks. I can hardly recall what Rebecca once looked like before she became this thing. Shiana searched for the memories and asked the voices within to assist her. This time they did, and she found what she wanted, like accessing old archival images. The woman had looked elegant in her brown robe and braided hair. She'd worn contact lenses to conceal the blue eyes of her spice addiction. With a bitter expression, the rabbi placed a hand on Rebecca's exposed flesh. A tear ran down his cheek. He muttered the same thing each time he visited her, a litany for him. You witches did this to her, made her into a monster. She's not a monster, not even a martyr. She tapped her own forehead. Rebecca's thoughts and memories are in here and inside many other sisters, shared with us all. Rebecca did what was necessary, and so will we. By making more golas? Will it never end? You are concerned about a pebble in your shoe, while we seek to avoid the rock slide. Sooner or later, we will no longer be able to run from the enemy. We'll need the ingenuity and special talents of these golas, in particular those capable of becoming another Kwisatz-Haderach. But we must handle the genetic material carefully, nurturing and developing it in the proper order, at the proper pace. She strolled to one of the new tanks, a fresh young woman whose form had not yet deteriorated into unrecognizability. As she stood there, a troubling thought refused to leave her mind, no matter how much she tried to push it away. An absurd line of reasoning, but all day long it had been percolating. What if my own abilities could be equivalent to those of a Kwisatz-Haderach? I already have a natural ability to control the great worms. I have the Atreides genes and centuries of the sisterhood's perfected knowledge to draw upon. Would I dare? She felt voices surfacing from within, One rose above the others. The ancient Reverend Mother Gaius Helen Mohiam, repeating something that she once said so long ago to a young Paul Atreides. Yet there's a place where no truth-sayer can see. We are repelled by it, terrorized. It is said a man will come one day and find in the gift of the drug his inward eye. He will look where we cannot, into both feminine and masculine pasts, the one who can be many places at once. The old crone's voice drifted away, without giving Shiana any advice, one way or the other. With a sneer, the rabbi interrupted her thoughts. And you trust that old Tlaloxu to help you when he's desperate to achieve his own goals before dying? Saitel hid those cells for so many years. How many of them contain dangerous secrets? You've already discovered face dancer cells among the samples. How many of your Gola abominations are traps laid by the Tlaloxu? She gazed at him dispassionately, knowing that no argument would ever sway him. The rabbi made the sign of the evil eye and fled. Duncan encountered Shiana in an empty corridor in the dimness of the artificial night. The no-ships, recyclers, and life support systems kept the air comfortably cool, but upon seeing her alone like this, Duncan felt a flush of heat. Shiana's large eyes fixed on him like a weapons targeting system. Feeling a tingle like static electricity on his skin, he cursed his body for being so easily tempted. Even now, 3 years after Shiana had broken the debilitating chains of Mirbella's love, the two of them still found themselves drawn irresistibly into unexpected bouts of sex as frenetic as any he and Mirbella had ever shared. Duncan preferred to manage the circumstances of their casual meetings, always trying to make certain that others were present, that he had safe guardrails to prevent him from falling off a dangerous cliff. He did not like to be out of control. That had already happened too many times. He and Shiana had surrendered to each other like terrified people huddling in a bombed-out battle zone. She had cauterized him to cure his debility and stolen him from Mirbella, yet he felt like a casualty of war. Now, as he saw Shiana's expression flicker, Duncan thought she felt the same sense of vertigo and disorientation. She tried to sound reserved and rational.
It is better if we don't do this. We have too many concerns, too many risks. Another regenerator system has just failed. The saboteur...
You're right. We should not. His voice was hoarse, but they had already started down a path with ever-increasing consequences. Duncan took a hesitant step forward. The muted corridor lights reflected off the no-ship's metal walls.
We shouldn't do this, he said again.
Desire swept like a wave over both of them. As a mentat, he could observe and assess, concluding that what they were doing was simply a reaffirmation of humanity. When they touched fingertips, lips, and skin, both of them were lost. Later, they rested on tangled sheets in Shiana's quarters. The air carried a moist muskiness. Duncan lay sated with his fingers laced in his wiry dark hair. He was confused and disappointed in himself. You've taken away too much of my control. Shiana raised her eyebrows in the dim light, showing amusement. Her breath was warm and close to his ear.
Oh? And Mirbella did not.
When Duncan turned away and did not answer, she chuckled.
You're feeling guilty. You think you've betrayed her somehow. But how many female imprinters did you train back on Chapter House?
He answered the question in his own way. Mirbella and I were trapped together, and no part of our relationship was voluntary. We had a mutual addiction, two people brought to a stalemate. That isn't love or tenderness. For Mirbella, for all of you witches, our lovemaking was supposed to be just business. But I still had feelings for her, damn it. It isn't a matter of whether or not I should. But you were like a violent detoxification of my system. The agony served the same purpose for Mirbella, breaking her bond to me. He reached out and cupped Shiana's chin. This cannot happen again. Now she looked even more amused.
I agree that it should not.
But it will anyway. You're a loaded weapon. A full Bene Gesserit. Every time we make love, you could easily let yourself get pregnant. Isn't that what the sisterhood would demand? You could carry my child whenever you allow yourself to do so.
True.
But I haven't. We are far from Chapter House, and I make my own decisions now. Shiana pulled him back to her.
Scientists see sandworms as specimens, while the Fremen see them as their god. But the worms devour anyone who tries to gather information. How am I supposed to work under such conditions?
Imperial planetologist Pardo Kynes, Ancient Records. Shiana stood in the high observation gallery where she and Garimi had once gone to discuss the future of their journey. The kilometer-long Great Hold was large enough to offer the illusion of freedom, though much too small for a brood of sandworms. The seven creatures were growing but remained stunted, waiting for the promised arid land. They had been waiting a long time, perhaps too long. More than two decades ago, Shiana had brought the small worms aboard the no-ship, stealing them from the growing desert band on Chapter House. She had always intended to transplant them to another world, far from the honored Matres and safe from the enemy. For years, the worms had zigzagged endlessly in the sand-filled confines of the hold, as lost as everyone else on the Ithaca. She wondered if the no-ship would ever find a planet where they could stop, where the sisters could establish a new and orthodox Chapter House, rather than the mongrel organization that made concessions to the ways of the honored Matres. If the ship simply fled for generations and generations, it would be impossible to find a perfect world for the sandworms, for Garimi and her conservative Bene Gesserits, for the rabbi and his Jews. She recalled searching other memory for advice the evening before. For a while there had been no response. Then Serena Butler, the ancient leader of the Jihad, came to her just as Shiana drifted off to sleep in her quarters. Long dead, Serena told of her experiences being lost and overwhelmed by an endless war, forced to guide vast populations when she herself didn't know where to go.
But you found your way, Serena. You did what you had to do. You did what humanity needed.
And so will you, Shiana. Now, seeing the sandworms ripple the sand far below, Shiana could sense their feelings in an indefinable way, and they could sense hers. Did they dream of endless, dry dunes in which to stake their territory? The largest of the worms, nearly 40 meters long, with a maw large enough to swallow 3 people abreast, was clearly dominant. Shiana had given that one a name. Monarch. The 7 worms pointed their eyeless faces toward her, displaying crystalline teeth. The smaller ones burrowed into the shallow sand, leaving only Monarch, who seemed to be summoning Shiana. She stared at the dominant worm, trying to understand what it wanted. The connection between them began to burn inside her, calling her. Shiana descended to the sand-filled cargo hold. Stepping out onto churned dunes, she strode directly toward the worm, unafraid. She had faced the creatures many times before and had nothing to fear from this one. Monarch towered over her. Putting her hands on her hips, Shiana looked up and waited. In the heady days on Rakkas, she had learned to dance on the sands and control the behemoths, but she had always known she could do more when she was ready. The worm seemed to be playing upon her need for understanding. She was the girl who could communicate with the beasts, who could control and understand them. And now, in order to see her own future, she had to go farther, literally and metaphorically. It was what Monarch wanted. Dangerous and frightening, the creature exhaled a stink of inner furnaces and pure melange.
"So, now what do we do, you and I? Are you Shaitan, or just an imposter?"
The restless worm seemed to know exactly what she had in mind. Instead of rolling its body toward her so she could climb its rings to ride, Monarch faced her with its round maw open. Each milky white tooth in a mouth the size of a cave opening was long enough to be used as a kris knife. Shiana did not tremble. The sandworm laid its head on the soft dunes directly in front of her, tempting her to a symbolic journey like Jonah and the whale. Shiana wrestled with her fears but knew what she must do. Not as a charlatan's performance, for she doubted anyone was watching her, but because it was necessary for her own understanding. Monarch lay waiting for her, mouth agape. The worm itself became a secret doorway, luring her like a dangerous lover. Shiana stepped past the portcullis of Chrisknife teeth and knelt inside the gullet, inhaling the rank cinnamon odor. Dizzy and nauseated, she could barely breathe. The sandworm did not move. Willingly, she worked her way deeper inside, offering herself, though convinced that her sacrifice would not be accepted. It wasn't what the worm wanted from her. Without looking back, she crawled farther down the throat into dry, dark warmth. Monarch did not twitch. Shiana kept going, felt her breathing slow. Deeper and deeper she went, and soon guessed that she had gone at least half the length of the prone worm. Without the friction heat sparked by roaming endless deserts, the worm's gullet was no longer a furnace. Her eyes became accustomed to what she realized was not total darkness, but was instead an eerie illumination that seemed more the product of another sense in her own mind than traditional eyesight. She could dimly see the rough, membranous surface around her, and as she proceeded, the undigested odor of melange precursors grew stronger, more concentrated. Finally, she reached a fleshy chamber that might have been Monarch's stomach, but without digestive acids. How did the captive sandworms survive? The odor of spice was more intense here than she had ever experienced, so much so that an ordinary person would have suffocated. "But I am no ordinary person." Shiana lay there, absorbing the warmth, letting the intense melange seep into every pore in her body, feeling Monarch's dim consciousness merge into hers. She inhaled deeply and felt a great cosmic sense of calm, like being in the womb of the great mother of the universe. Unexpectedly, with the unusual visitor deep in its gullet, the sandworm dove into the artificial desert and began to move through it, taking her on a strange journey. As if connected directly with Monarch's nervous system, Shiana could see through the eyeless worm to its companions beneath the sand. Working together, the seven sandworms were forming small veins of spice in the cargo hold.
Preparing.
Shiana lost track of time and thought again of Leto II, whose pearl of awareness was now inside this beast and all of the others in the hold. She wondered where she fit into this paranormal realm. As the God Emperor's queen? As the female part of the Godhead? Or as something else entirely, an entity she could not begin to imagine? The worms all carried secrets, and Shiana understood how much the Gola children were like that as well. They each held a treasure greater than spice within their cells, their past memories and lives. Paul and Chaney, Jessica, Yui, Leto II, even Thufir Hawat, Stilgar, Liet Kynes, and now baby Aaliyah. Each had a crucial role to play, but only if they could remember who they were. She saw each image, but not in her own imagination. The sandworms knew what those lost figures contained. An urgency rushed toward her like a desert wind. Time, and with it their chances for survival, was slipping away too quickly. She envisioned a succession of the possible Golas, all primed like weapons, but blurred as to what each could do. She could not wait for the enemy. She had to act now. The worm resurfaced, and after moving along the sands, it jolted to a stop. Inside, Shiana caught her balance. Then, by constricting its membranous interior, the creature gently pushed her back out. She crawled from the mouth and tumbled onto the sands. Dust and grit clung to the film coating her body. Monarch nudged her, like a mother bird urging a chick to go out on its own. Caught up in disorienting visions, she struggled and dropped to her knees on the dry sand. The faces of the Gola children wavered around her, dissolving into bright lights.
Awaken!
She lay gasping for breath, her body and clothing drenched in spice essence. Beside Shiana, the big worm turned, burrowed back into the shallow sand, and disappeared from view. Reeking and reeling, Shiana made her way back toward the cargo hold doors, but she kept losing her footing and falling. She had to reach the Gola children. The worm had given her an important message, something that seeped into her consciousness like a wordless form of other memory. In moments, she was left with an overwhelming certainty of what she had to do.
You say that we must learn from the past, but I fear the past, for I have been there. And I have no desire to return.
Dr. Wellington Yui, the Gola. After being scrubbed and showered to rid her of a spice reek so strong that even the sisters who assisted her covered their mouths and noses, Shiana slept for 2 days in deep and disturbing dreams. When she finally emerged and found Duncan Idaho and Miles Tegg on the navigation bridge, she made her announcement.
The Golas are all old enough. Even Leto II is the same age as when I restored the Bashar.
The smell of melange was heavy on Shiana's breath.
It's time to awaken them all.
Duncan turned his back on the observation window where he stood. Triggering the process isn't like activating a subroutine or working through a bout of temporary amnesia. You can't just issue a memo and order it done.
The Gola children have always known that we would demand this of them, she said. Without their past memories, without their genius, they are of no more value to us than any other children.
The Bashar nodded slowly.
To recall a Gola's past life is an experience that destroys and recreates the psyche. There are numerous proven methods, some more painful than others, but none are easy.
You can't awaken the children all at once. Each critical event must be tailored to the individual. A horrible, mind-shattering crisis. Tegg's face showed echoes of pain.
You thought you were using a humane awakening method with me, Shiana, when I was only a 10-year-old child.
Though Duncan, too, seemed uneasy at the prospect, he stepped down from the observation window and walked toward Shiana.
She's right, Miles. We created those golas for a purpose, and right now they're all like unloaded guns. We need to load our golas, our unique weapons. The enemy's net is stronger now, and it nearly snared us again. We all saw it. Next time, we may not be able to slip away.
We've waited long enough.
Shiana's voice was hard, brooking no argument.
Some golas may be more challenging than others.
Tag's eyes narrowed. You may lose some to madness. Are you prepared for that?
I have gone through the spice agony, as have all reverend mothers on this ship. We survived the unbearable pain.
I have the memories of my old life, Tegg said, of wars and atrocities and enduring unbearable torture. Somehow the bad details are much more vivid than the pleasant ones. But nothing is worse than the awakening.
Shiana waved her hand.
Throughout history, men and women have had a monopoly on their own kinds of pain, each thinking theirs is the worst.
She smiled grimly.
We will start with the least valuable gola, of course, in case something goes wrong.
Wellington Yui was summoned to stand before the Bene Gesserits in one of the no-ship's council chambers. The gangly teenager had a pointed chin and pinched lips. Already buried within his face were hints of the familiar chiseled features and broad forehead, the despised visage that had become synonymous with the word traitor for thousands of years in galactic reference works. The young man was nervous, fidgeting. Shiana drew herself to her full height and stepped closer. He flinched at her intimidating presence, but somehow found the courage to stand where he was.
You summoned me, Reverend Mother. How may I assist?
By awakening your memories. Tomorrow you will be the first of our subjects to undergo the trigger.
Yui's yellowish face paled.
But I'm not ready.
That is why we have given you a full day to prepare.
Proctor Superior Garimi's tongue was sharp, as usual. Although Garimi had never embraced the project, she now wanted to see its culmination. Shiana knew what she was thinking. If the awakening process failed, Garimi intended to prevent any further golas from being grown. If the awakening succeeded, she would insist that the program had fulfilled its goal and could be discontinued. She knew that Shiana, still intrigued by all those cells in the Tliloxu's null entropy capsule, was planning further Gola experiments.
Yui's legs were locked. He seemed close to fainting and grasped a nearby chair to steady himself.
Sisters, I don't want to have my memories back. I am not the man you think you resurrected, but a new person. My own person. The old Wellington Yui was tormented in so many ways. Even though he was in part me, how can I forgive him for what he did?
Garimi made a dismissive gesture. Nevertheless, we brought you back for one purpose only. Don't expect sympathy from us. You have a task to perform.
After the proctors took the distraught young man away, Shiana looked at Garimi and two other senior sisters, Kalissa and Elian, who had observed the discussion.
I will use the sexual method on him, the same one that worked on the Gola of the Bashar. It is the best technique we know.
Elian said, Your sexual imprinting unlocked the Bashar's memories only because it precipitated a crisis in him. Teg's mother had armed him against sexual imprinting.